So it's so nice to be here with everyone, and thank you for inviting me back, Birgit. I always like being down there. I look forward to meeting in the Friends Meeting House when it's safe to do that again sometime. So I just want to sort of give a shout out to all of you at this point in the COVID-19 business. You know, so many people are just sort of, they've had it up to here with all the Zoom sessions. So here you are tonight to meet and to meditate together and to listen to some, to a talk on the Dhamma. And I just really want to bow to you for your, for whatever it is that stirs you to show up over and over again. So with that, I want to just introduce the theme that I'm going to talk about tonight. Basically, it emerges over the conditions that we find ourselves confronting in the world that we live in, this pandemic of COVID-19 and the tragic numbers of people infected and the numbers of people who have died from it, and also the business with George Floyd in Minneapolis, and now the new event in Atlanta, and the sort of the exposure of the systematic kind of racism that exists, not just in America, but it's not just our problem, it's all over the world. But these things are big challenges. So I wanted to talk on the theme of common humanity. And it's a theme that runs through many religions and wisdom traditions. And we hear it in phrases like do unto others as you would do unto yourself, or basically we're all in this together. So if this is true, how are we all in this together? So there's a Tibetan teacher here in the Bay Area named Anand Tupten, and he teaches out in Point Richmond. And he says, humanity is one family, and everyone's struggle is our struggle. So common humanity, how is it that everyone's struggle is our struggle, and what does it mean to treat our neighbor as we would treat ourselves? So from a social science point of view, common humanity could be understood as having two qualities, the quality of recognizing the sameness in ourselves and in others, and then also this quality of interconnectedness. So in terms of sameness, what we mean is that all people at their core basically don't want to suffer. All people want to be happy. I had a student at Stanford say to me, would you stop saying everybody wants to be happy? I don't want to be happy. I said, really? Do you want to suffer? And she said, no, of course not. Said, well, that's what I mean by everybody wants to be happy. In this way, we are all the same. We know what it's like to suffer and to not want to suffer. And so much of our lives is devoted in some way, sometimes it's explicit and sometimes it's implicit, but ways to try to avoid suffering or mitigate suffering or just deny suffering. And then this quality of interconnectedness is simply that we don't exist in a vacuum, or no person is an island. Everything that we take for granted is dependent on other people. The clothes that we wear, the food that we eat, the cars that we drive, the technology that we're using right now, all of this is part of the human gift to one another. So as human beings, I think it's fair to say that we're all faced with the ever-changing nature of causes and conditions. Things are changing constantly. And any attempt on our part to nail things down is just going to end up frustrating us. So today we see that we're facing multiple pandemics in our own backyard, the COVID-19, as I mentioned, systemic racism, economic upheaval. We're facing a culture of lying, obscene income disparity. And that's what we're facing today. What we'll be facing tomorrow, who knows? So as we lean into our experience rather than running away from our experience, we can see old, really deeply ingrained karmic propensities being triggered by the things that are occupying our day in and day out experience, the sheltering in place. I've been in my little cottage since March the 19th. It's a wonder I'm not cuckoo. And so it's so easy to be triggered by both small and really big challenges. And when we're triggered or when we're scared, we lose touch with the very best parts of ourselves, not to mention the best versions of ourselves. And we can end up feeling separate and isolated whenever we categorize people in groups as others, which is what we do. Whether we like it or not, that's what we do. We descend into really extreme forms of binary thinking or racial profiling. We kind of revert to sort of a basic tribalism in a way. But, you know, this pandemic, I keep pointing to COVID-19, it's really a global event. It's a global threat. And 5 years from now, you can almost be sure that if you ask people all over the globe, what was it like for them during this? Everyone would have a story. Everyone would have a story to tell. So as we face this pandemic and the fallout from this pandemic and the toxic systemic nature of racism, in a way, we're all being called on to respond. And we can choose to respond with compassion. COVID-19 is not only a medical event, and racism is not just an American issue. In the face of these challenges, the question we can ask ourselves is, who are we going to be? Who do we want to be? Who are we going to be? So these conditions that we find ourselves in are simultaneously both threatening, and they're also filled with opportunity for profound and radical change, not only on a personal level, but on a societal level. And maybe even the kind of change that we could label transformative. So it's both a threat and an opportunity. It's very much, this is what compassion is. It's always a both and. It's never an either or. It doesn't exclude any part of it and includes everything. So it's always a both and. And compassion can hold the divisions that we see in the external world and also the divisions that we deal with within ourselves. You see, we might want to be compassionate, but we're really feeling irritated or we're feeling impatient. And the last thing that we're willing to do is be compassionate to somebody who's being difficult. So compassion as a quality requires courage and it requires strength. It's not in any way a form of capitulation. So many people think that being compassionate means being nice, not rocking the boat, being a doormat in a way. But compassion doesn't mean that. It doesn't mean capitulation. It doesn't mean being nice. It doesn't mean being quiet. It doesn't mean not speaking up or speaking truth to power when confronting the very real issues that we're all dealing with and that are upon us today. These are all examples of the ways that fears of compassion block true compassion. And those fears will not do the important or the vital work of compassion. Compassion heals. Compassion does not condemn. Compassion does not blame. Compassion does not other, nor does it isolate. So, again, we might ask ourselves the following questions. Where are we ourselves challenged in relation to being able to feel and offer genuine compassion to one another or to our fellow human beings? Where are we challenged right now, just thinking about our neighbors or the instruction or the suggestion to love your neighbor or love your enemy? What does that bring up in you? Where do you feel a response? The teaching that hate is never solved by hate, but by love alone is hatred healed, is a really profound teaching. It's so obvious that we miss it. But when you meet hatred with hatred, when you meet contention with contention, it's not very likely that we're going to come to some place of resolution or some place of transformation. So I want to do a little brief exercise with you. And before we do this exercise, I'm going to set it up by reading a poem to you by one of my favorite poets, a man named John O'Donohue, and it's called New Beginnings. And I'm going to ask you to close your eyes or invite you to close your eyes when I read this poem, and then keep your eyes closed when I go through this exercise with you, which will be, it'll just be a short exercise. And if at any point in the exercise you feel like you just don't want to participate, it's fine. Just you're in total control. So you do as you see fit. So if you're ready, and if you haven't already, I'm going to invite you to close your eyes. And this poem is called New Beginnings. In out-of-the-way places of the heart where your thoughts never think to wander, this beginning has been quietly forming, waiting until you were ready to emerge. For a long time, it has watched your desire, feeling the emptiness grow inside you, noticing how you willed yourself on, still unable to leave what you had outgrown. It watched you play with the seduction of safety and the gray promises that sameness whispered. Heard the waves of turmoil rise and relent. Wondered, would you always live like this? Then the delight when your courage kindled and out you stepped onto new ground. Your eyes young again with energy and dream a path of plenitude opening before you. Though your destination is not clear, you can trust the promise of this opening. Unfurl yourself into the grace of beginning that is one with your life's desire. Awaken your spirit to adventure, hold nothing back, learn to find ease in risk. Soon you will be home in a new rhythm, for your soul senses the world that awaits you. So take a nice deep breath in and out. And imagine that you can breathe directly into and out of your heart center. And just take a breath or two like that. And as you're breathing into and out of your heart center, I want you to reflect that just like you, your neighbors, everybody on this Zoom call with you in this session tonight, all the people that you know and care about, and even the people that you don't know, and possibly even people that you don't care about, if you're willing to stretch your compassion muscle, just realize that just like you, they also know what it's like to feel utterly alone. They all also know what it's feel like, what it feels like to feel rejected or afraid or dismissed or unnoticed. They know what it's like to be treated like they don't matter or even exist. They know what it's like to be hurt by their loved ones or hurt by the sting of hurting their loved ones. This way, they're no different from you, and you're no different from them. Now, as you breathe in, I invite you to experiment with being willing to acknowledge their suffering, which is just like your own, to be willing to meet it. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to take it on. You just acknowledge that others are suffering just like you. And as you exhale, just for this moment, experiment with sending them the wish to be free from suffering, breathing out compassion and loving kindness for your neighbors. Even for your enemies. Imagine that this is possible. And know that each one of you has this power. And again, you might ask yourself the following question. What is one thing that I can do for them? One action or one small act of compassion or loving kindness that I can do for them? Now, for just a few moments, allow yourself to relax and feel into whatever might be arising in you. And in your own time, whenever you're ready, you can open your eyes and come back into the group. When we take the time to look closely, we discover that there's a gap between that which triggers us and our reaction or responses. And it's in that gap that we have a moment of choice. But the trick is learning how to recognize that gap. Learning what it feels like to be there, to notice what it's like to be triggered. We might be triggered by thoughts, we might be triggered by emotions, sensations, mind states or mind traits. These are all triggers. You see? And with this quality of mindfulness, we can begin to recognize those triggers. We can begin to recognize what's arising. Those things arise as some form of contact. See, we can begin to recognize what it is exactly that's arising. And as I said a moment ago, in the gap between what's arising and our responses lies choice, the choice of how to respond. It's really right there in that moment where choice resides. I want to say that again because this is a little bit subtle, but it's really important. It's right there in that moment between the arising of the trigger and the moment of responding that we have an opportunity to choose. So we can recognize the nature of our response when we respond. Because our response, whether we're aware of it or not, is always a choice. Mind states and mind traits. What I mean by a mind state is it's a quality that arises and persists for a while, and then it passes away, like a flash of anger or a moment of being startled or frustrated. It comes, it abides for a while, and it passes away. A trait is more enduring. It's almost like a personality quality. So some of us are, we have a shorter fuse than others. So we're given to anger. Others of us are more anxious, or we worry more than others. And it becomes like a trait. It's a trait of ours. So mind states and traits are really perspectives. They're narratives, and they can be positive or narrative, or positive or narrative, positive or negative. And these are things that we live with day in and day out. And whether they're positive or negative, or whether they're a state or a trait, they color our experience of reality. So whether we're being affected by thinking or by emotions or by bodily or mental sensations, by mind states or mind traits, we are always, always the immediate and direct recipient of whatever we happen to be thinking or feeling or saying or doing. So by merely inclining the mind in a certain direction, we react or respond to stimuli in ways that when we repeat these ways of reacting or responding, over time, they become habits. And neurologically, we actually begin to default to these habits because we've practiced them so much. And as I mentioned a moment earlier, we can, our response can be positive or negative. You see, not only our thoughts and our actions, but the way that we respond to them. So when we truly begin to see this as a direct experience, when we begin to see and get this as a direct experience, we begin to understand that we actually choose different mental models, that we're actually making a choice. And the Buddha taught this thousands of years ago, and it's been taught ever since, and it's being taught in schools and universities all over the world today. And they're using a term mental models instead of the classic Buddhist terms that we've been practicing with for some of us for decades. But the long and the short of it is the way that we incline the mind towards an essentially benevolent world or an inherently dangerous worldview will determine our experience, because we are always the direct and immediate recipient of whatever we're thinking or feeling or even imagining. So it's really important what we put into our consciousness and what we put boundaries around, so that we don't pollute our consciousness. And the state of our mind influences our reactions and our responses to the circumstances and conditions in which we find ourselves. So if we're angry and we respond with anger, you know, this is not really very helpful. So when we hold to like a worldview that the world is inherently dangerous and that pain is bad, we recoil by default. We resist by default. And when we do that, we create suffering for ourselves. You see, it's like the story, the Buddhist story of the two arrows, where a soldier gets pierced by an arrow and he won't let his fellow soldiers remove the arrow until he asks a series of questions. And it's that series of questions, those second, third, fourth, and hundredth arrow that we add to the pain. This is the suffering aspect. So when we view the world, when our perspective is that pain is bad, we just resist and recoil by default. And then we're bound to suffering, to suffer. But I want to make a distinction here, because what most people do is, in meeting this place of suffering, this place that's the same in everyone. Everyone knows what it's like to suffer, but I suffer my way and you suffer your way and you suffer your way. And the details of the suffering are unique to each one of us, but the experience of suffering is universal. We all know what it's like to suffer, you see? So when we meet a moment of suffering, what many of us do, including myself, I still do this, is I resist the suffering. You know, I try to push it away. I try to not suffer. I don't want to suffer. Who wants to suffer? Why would you want to suffer? You see, but what I'm doing is I'm adding a quality of resistance to the actual experience, and I'm not any longer recognizing the experience for what the experience is. You see, and resistance in itself is inherently stressful. It's a state of being in which we're in contention with what is or isn't what is or is not the way we want things to be. So any moment when things are other than how we would prefer them to be is a moment of resistance, a moment of suffering. And it's a moment that we create ourselves. We just don't realize that we're doing that. And when we move away from suffering and fall into resistance, we move into a place where we're acting, we're pushing against the truth of our experience, and we're reacting to the perception of suffering, which we deny, which we're in denial of, literally. And because compassion itself is always and only a response to suffering, which is an undeniable part of the human experience. I realize I'm talking about suffering a lot tonight, but it's so up in the conditions we find ourselves in. But compassion is always and only a response to suffering. But when we can't be with suffering, when we don't see suffering, when we react with resistance, you see, what we will respond with is not compassion. We are going to respond with something, but it's not compassion. Compassion responds to suffering. And this is good news and bad news, because the good news is that we're off the hook. We don't have to make ourselves feel compassionate for our neighbors or even our enemies, you see. The fact is, when we can be with suffering directly, our own or with someone else's suffering, the heart will respond with compassion. That's the natural movement of the heart to encountering suffering. One of my monastic teachers, a man named Ajahn Suchito, some of you are probably aware of Ajahn Suchito and his teachings, he describes compassion in a very succinct and beautiful way. I love this. I use this in my classes all the time. He says, when love encounters suffering, the heart's natural response is compassion. It's the only way the heart can respond, because compassion is an expression of love in response to suffering. So I took a whole training program and spent years studying this, and he says it in one sentence. I'm thinking, I should have stuck with the monk. So compassion is always and only a response to suffering. That being said, though, everything that happens to us has some kind of deeper spiritual purpose. And everything that happens, even if it's difficult, it's an opportunity for us to practice this quality of touching this experience of unconditional love. So sometimes the people in our lives who we find irritating are difficult. Sometimes just with a shift in perspective, we can recognize that they're actually our teachers and they're demanding a lot from us, sometimes more than we're willing to give, or sometimes more than we think we can give. But learning to practice, learning to be with our experience in this very direct way, without any expectation or desire, or even the need to get something or to get somewhere, this is a sign of maturing practice. This is a sign of your practice maturing. So learning to practice in that way is really quite beautiful, and it's worth taking note of. Our sincere practice is a gift to the world that we live in. it's impossible for any one of us to practice only for ourselves. What we do together. We are all part of the human family, and how we think and speak and act in the world really does make a difference. And it always makes a difference. So speak and act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows like the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. Speak or act with a loving mind, a clear mind, a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never departing shadow. That's the first verse from the Dhammapada. So I only have 5 more minutes, and I just want to try to get something in quickly. I wanted to leave a little bit of time for questions and answers, but I want to talk about how hindrances and triggers show up to in our lives to really create problems for us being able to access this type of clarity and this type of heart response. So whenever we find ourselves up against the feeling, now what the heck should I do? You can know that your mind has been activated and taken over. The thinking mind has taken over. And what it means is that we've arrived at a place of reactivity. Our nervous system's engaged as if we're threatened, as though we're under threat. And we often default to a kind of a fight, flight, freeze response, something that Daniel Goleman refers to as an amygdala hijack. I'm sure everybody knows what it's like, this fight, flight, freeze business. So when that happens, we're no longer present with ourselves. And what's happening is that we're caught up reacting to triggering stimuli, whether the stimuli is external or internal. So the moment of choice that I was talking about earlier, that gap between what's arising and our response to it, that's temporarily evaporated and we no longer have access to it. Whatever's happening will pass sooner or later and we'll get another chance. But in that moment, we've sort of lost it. So we lose our balance whenever we're challenged by resistance to our actual experience. When we're resisting our actual experience, we're out of balance. So some of the barriers to knowing when we're in balance and we're out of balance, knowing that a moment of non-resistance is actually a moment of freedom, an expression of love. We can learn to recognize it for what it is, but it takes practice, and there are these barriers. And there's a difference between the hindrances that hinder us in meditation and in life, and the triggers that may activate the hindrances. So triggers versus actual hindrances. The hindrances are the desire of wanting or not wanting, the aversion, the not wanting, the avoidance, the restlessness, the remorse that we might feel, the doubts. These are all classic meditative hindrances. But triggers are both hysteric and historic. They're recognized in the stories, the narratives, and the content of the narratives that we tell ourselves over and over and over again. And you can see and recognize the triggers and the details of the narrative about your relationships or the way that you're reacting or responding to the conditions and events in your lives. So these can be physical, they can be emotional, they can be mental, but our nervous system can be triggered into a state of overwhelm. And when that happens, it exacerbates this threat response, this amygdala hijack. So recognizing this distinction requires a level of mindfulness from each one of us in order to give us access to the maturing of compassion and loving kindness, to the full flowering and expression of it. And both compassion and loving kindness are characterized by an absence of aversion, by an absence of ill will, by an absence of enmity. These things cannot exist at the same moment as compassion and loving kindness. And understanding this and practicing this gives us access to a dimension of our own consciousness that always remains untouched by those primitive negative forces. So, how do you practice this? With patience and with kindness and with a few basic, simple little techniques that I'm going to offer you here. Just obvious things. You can start your day by recognizing that you're alive and that you have another day, and by setting an intention for yourself, which doesn't have to be some major life-changing intention. It could be just some intention. Just know what you're intending to do that day or what you're intending to pay attention to. And then remind yourself throughout the day of your intention. I have a friend who says he sets his watch for every 14 minutes to you know, vibrate, just to remind him to practice what he intends to. And this is a way that you can keep track and recognize your response. This is how you can know that we're truly all in this together as one human family. All of us are facing the things that I mentioned in this short talk tonight. And what we do, each one of us, really matters. Believe it or not, we like to just sort of blank out and pretend that, you know, what we do doesn't really make that much difference. Every action that we take makes a difference. It matters to us, and it makes a difference in the world. So may what you intend, and may what you do, and may what I intend, and may what I do be for the benefit of all of our sisters and brothers. And may it always spring from kindness and unconditional love.